All right, I'll call the case of Hector Hernandez versus Plastipak Packaging.
Hello,
Mr. Cummings.
May it please the court, this is Michael Cummings for Appellant Plastipak Packaging, Inc. So we're here today to talk about the fluctuating workweek rule. And try to put it as simply as possible, it deals with overtime situations for non-exempt salaried employees when they have a fixed salary or a fixed weekly wage, as has been stated, but they have variable hours. Since the overtime statute, Section 7 of the Fair Labor Standards Act, talks in terms of a regular rate. You get overtime at a half of your regular rate. It was immediately an issue, what do you do with a salaried employee? How do you come to that regular rate? And the fluctuating work week rule is that answer. You take the entire salary and you divide it by the number of hours worked in any given week, and that is your rate. And so the rate fluctuates as the hours fluctuate. The more hours, the lower the rate. And we've thrown a lot of examples in the brief, and I was half tempted to put up a graph for you, but I think the concept is clear. So the question is, where does this rule come from? And of course, if you look at the statute itself, Section 7 doesn't mention anything like it. As the courts have recognized it and written in terms of hourly wages, so it was the Supreme Court in the Missile case, Overnight Motor Transportation Court v. Missile, that established definitively the fluctuating work week rule. It had been earlier promulgated as an interpretive rule by the Department of Labor almost immediately after the effective date of the statute in 1938. And of course, Missile winds up ratifying that rule. It does it in the footnote, but it was more explicit in the lower court cases. So that is so essentially the regular rate for terms of overtime is fluctuating in this situation. Again, fixed salary with variable hours. I think it's important to take a quick look at the statute before we move on, and particularly the last phrase of Section A1. You know, it says, the basic structure is you can't work more than the overtime rate, 40 hours now, unless the employee is paid for these excess hours at a rate not less than 1.5 times the regular rate at which he's employed. And the one point there I'd like to make very quickly is that it is two numbers there. There's one and there's 1.5. One is what we call it, always called straight time. That is what you are going to get anyway. You're working $20 an hour, you still get that $20 per hour in your overtime hours. And the 1.5, which is the deal, is called a 50% bonus. Your overtime is 50%. In the case of the fluctuating work week, what you get already is your salary. You're getting a fixed salary, whatever it is per week, $1,500, $2,000. You're getting that, and you continue to get that because that's what you always get. It's the same amount. So the bonus is 50% of this fluctuating regular rate. And this comes right from Missile itself. And I think the next point to turn is Missile there.
Interrupt real quick. So sure. the problem here, right, is that the district court said, and I think it's undisputed, that the plaintiff was not being paid the same salary every week. His rate was fluctuating based on his hours, right?
No, that's not your rate. And it's the terminology. We're distinguishing between salary and entire compensation, and that is the crux of the issue here. The question is whether the entire compensation package.
In answering his question, be mindful that the district court order says the record reflects that Hernandez's straight time pay was not fixed, period. Rather, his pay varied each week depending on whether he received night shift premium pay or holiday pay.
We don't dispute that. Straight time pay is the requirement that the entire straight time pay be fixed is a mistake. It's wrong. The O'Brien case, the First Circuit case, I think it was 2003, misinterpreted and interpretative rule. It failed, as it should have, to compare its interpretation against Missile. So in a footnote in that case, it says we're not comparing it to Missile because the parties aren't arguing that. So that's the story. It made two mistakes. It failed to compare whether this strict rule that the entire straight time pay, not just we're saying as long as you have a fixed salary in there, and that fixed salary is fixed in there, you can add things on top of it. And Missile, of course, does not directly deal with this issue, but its reasoning, it says, look, we're going to look at the economic reality. Apart from the statute, apart from the act, if you have a fixed weekly wage, your rate varies. That's an economic reality for a fixed salary that doesn't change when you put something on top of it. So if somebody in this case earns a shift premium, the employer's not going to say, oh, well, you earned a shift premium last night. We're going to treat you as hourly now. And since you only worked 20 hours this week, we're paying you half pay. No, that doesn't what happened. You have that salary. It's a salary in there must be fixed. It's a complete misreading of the wording of one of section, the CFR 778.114. It's a misreading of that statement. And more importantly, that's only an interpretive rule anyway. The district court, any of these courts should have gone back to Missile and say, does that make sense against Missile? Does Missile require that? Does the logic? And it doesn't, because if you have the principle of Missile, that we're going to look at the economic reality situation. And the economic reality is that when you have a fixed salary, it's fixed no matter what you put on top of it. It's fixed in what you're actually paid. It's fixed in the employment. It's also fixed in the understanding of the employees. No employee thinks that if I get a shift premium, they're going to dock me off my fixed salary, nor do they expect that if I get a shift premium, if I work twice as many hours, I'm going to get paid double on my fixed salary. In the thinking of the employees, in the economic reality, that salary was fixed. And Missile stands that whatever you get a fixed salary, whether there's anything added on to not, Missile applies. You would be violating Missile. You would be contravening Missile if you had a fixed salary.
Mr. Cummings, so you rely so heavily on Missile, and you read it to say something I don't see it saying. I mean, you say that it says paying one half wage for hours over 40 is justified by Missile.
Yes, because Missile tells you what you do when you get a fixed salary.
Where does it say that? Where does it say half pay for hours over 40?
Actually, it says it in footnote 16, to be frank. And that's what was the holding of the circuit court below.
Footnote 16 says wage divided by hours equals regular pay, time and a half regular rate for hours employed beyond statutory maximum equals compensation for overtime hours. I mean, it doesn't say half time for hours over 40.
Well, you have to distinguish that you're already getting your time. What it's saying is you get your time. That's why there's two numbers there. The time is what you get anyway. The time is your salary. Your one
time,
that is your straight time pay. And you get a half of your regular rate. So your regular rate is already what's in your salary. Otherwise, it wouldn't be making sense. If you're going to be adding some kind of hourly rate on top of the salary, then the whole Missile structure falls apart. Why would you bother dividing entire hours? If somebody works 60, why would you divide the salary by 60 hours if that wasn't what the regular rate was the whole time? The salary covers that entire time. It covers 40 hours, it covers 10 hours, it covers 80 hours. You get a fixed salary. That is your time. That is your straight time pay. And if you want to take a minute, we'll go into the mistake that Missile made, because it was but the point is there. And I will indulge the court for a couple of general interpretive rules here and I think we'll get to Walling v. Bellow, because, it's basically saying, I'll give it to you, Walling v. Bellow, 62, 316 U.S. 624, we're on page 635 U.S., pretty much the end of the main opinion before the dissent, and it's given us some interpretating rule. The actual was just sort of a fixed minimum here. This is when employers and employees have an agreed upon arrangement. And the agreed upon, there's no mistake. When there's no shift premium involved, there's no issue here what the understanding is. The understanding is I get this fixed salary and I may get something on top of it sometimes and sometimes not. So you have 1 week where he has no shift premium, and the next week where he gets a shift premium, that fixed salary doesn't change. His one time, his straight time pay only changes because it's been added to. That fixed part is just as fixed. When you have, adding 3% on top of the salary doesn't change that fixed part of it.
So let me ask you a question about this. And this is something that has been bothering me about this case, which is, in your view, is there any difference between a minimum fixed weekly wage and a fixed weekly wage? That is, could you just always have a minimum fixed weekly wage and just put whatever you want to on top of it, no matter what?
Conceptually, no, Your Honor. Conceptually, you could have, there's nothing that prevents a mixed compensation package, part fixed, part hourly. And the rules are pretty simple. That fixed part, that part is fixed, gets the fluctuating workweek rule. The part that's hourly gets the hourly rule. Very simple, because it goes to the economic reality. Your straight time pay on a fixed surrender, that part of your compensation that's fixed, is fixed for all the hours. So it is the straight time pay. And you see, because MISL is going on the economic reality. I work a fixed pay, I work variable hours, that part is fixed. So there's no reason not to handle any fixed component. Now, if it was a trivial amount, de minimis or something. But here we're not, we're talking about an occasional 3% bonus on top. But conceptually, the economic understanding of the parties is a quotient. You have straight time pay at that one time required by the statute. That's what MISL holds. That one time is already coming in from the salary. Otherwise, MISL makes no sense at all. You know, it's completely nonsensical that if all of a sudden you stop at 40 hours, then start one time becomes some kind of hourly rate and you're transformed to an hourly employee at that time, or that part of your pay gets transformed from fixed to hourly. No, it doesn't. The economic standing understanding between the parties is that it is fixed for all those hours. And therefore, MISL tells you how you calculate the regular rate for a fixed salary. And I mean, one context, the Department of Labor at the time, which is ratified in MISL, clearly interchanges the term fixed basic salary and fixed weekly salary in the interpretive bulletin number 4. And its next interpretation, the same year as MISL, specifically talked about a minimum salary. It used that word. So that was the understanding the Department of Labor. That was the understanding of it that was ratified by MISL. It was much more explicit, I meant, in the Department of Labor. But it's true that in footnote, I believe it's 17, it ratifies it. It says, we approve. With this interpretive rule, we approve, we bless it. It's the law. And that's what
you get. Mr. Cummings, your time is up. Will you say 3 minutes for rebuttal?
We'll I'll take 2.5. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, well, that's okay. We'll give you 3.
Okay.
May it please the court, Andrew Frisch for the appellee, Hector Hernandez. Because the fluctuating work week can undermine the FLSA's remedial nature, an employer may only pay halftime overtime under the fluctuating work week if and only if certain factors are met. PlastiPak can only apply the fluctuating work week here and comply with the FLSA legally to the extent it can establish that Hernandez's hours fluctuating from week to week, that Hernandez receives a fixed amount of straight time pay that did not vary depending on the number or type of hours that he worked during each work week, excluding the overtime premiums, that the amount that he received compensated him in excess of minimum wage, and that PlastiPak and Hernandez share a clear mutual understanding that PlastiPak will pay the fixed amount for straight time pay, irregardless of the number and type of hours worked. As relevant here, the fluctuating work week requires a fixed weekly wage, as counsel for appellant acknowledged, and that the fixed weekly wage must be divided by all hours worked. Here, both of these critical elements are lacking. Moreover, PlastiPak may not rely on the fluctuating work week, where here his base salary was not intended to cover all hours of work, but was only intended to cover the first 40 hours of work each week, and where PlastiPak paid Hernandez only straight time or the same rate for both his non-overtime hours and his overtime hours worked. Notwithstanding PlastiPak's conclusory assertions that the law from Missile all the way to date is every court was mistaken. The DOL has been mistaken. Its briefs are devoid of any authority supporting the notion that the pay policy issue complies with the FLSA. Instead, an avalanche of authority from courts and the Department of Labor.
Counsel, are you saying there's no authority from the Department of Labor ever on whether some sort of pay differential, whether a ship premium or some sort of bonus or commission or whatever, on top of a fixed salary defeats completely the fluctuating work week? Is that your contention?
I think the law as it applied at the time that the district court ruled in this case, that's accurate. There was never a court or the Department of Labor that said that you could just add a fixed minimum wage, to answer Judge Brasher's question, that a minimum fixed wage was the same as a fixed amount for straight time pay.
What about an interpretive bulletin 4, which is the very thing that Meisel purported to adopt, or at least use as an understanding of what this all means?
I don't think that bulletin explicitly said that you could add additional pay.
So I'm looking at the interpretive bulletin right now, and this is at interpretive bulletin, and it's numbered, so this is number 7 on the bulletin. And it says the regular hourly rate of pay is arrived at in various cases as follows. And then it gives as an example number 4, the weekly wage, and then in parentheses it says, including production bonuses, if any, end parentheses, averaged over the total hours worked each work week where there is no regular number of hours. In other words, exactly the situation we have here. That seems to contemplate exactly a production bonus, right?
I think the wording could certainly be read in the way that you're saying. I think
how else can it be read?
Well, I don't know that it explicitly blesses that, but that is certainly the example that they give.
Of how to calculate exactly this sort of scenario, which is someone's paid a weekly wage, and that weekly wage includes a bonus. And then it's averaged over the total hours each work week, so divided by the total hours worked, and there's no regular number of hours. In other words, the hours fluctuate per week. That isn't that exactly what the Supreme Court was referring to in Meisel?
No, that is not what the Supreme Court was referring to in Missile. In Missile, the court was only looking at a pay or compensation that solely dealt with a salary. There was no
what about the 2000
bonus or any bonus of any type? And the other thing is,
Counsel, what about the 1999 wage and hour letter that was asked by a federal employee or some sort of federal employer about what to do where the employer paid a fixed salary but had accrued leave and had some bonus time that were to pay out? Didn't DOL specifically give them authority to use the fluctuating work week, even though they were paid some sort of additional compensation on top?
Yes, and the distinguishing characteristic in both of the cases, meaning administrative letter 4 and the DOL letter, is that those, in both scenarios, neither of the bonuses were tied to hours worked or type of hours worked in the work week at issue. So
I just want to be clear. So it's okay to pay as long as that additional money is not tied to the type of hour work. Is that the rule? Where is that in
that? Yes.
Where is that in 114?
Where is that
regulation?
It's in the applicable regulation in A. It refers to. It's also in the preamble to the 2011.
But as I understand your position and the district court position, is it is either a fixed salary, you got to pay this and nothing else, and if you get paid something else, then it defeats the fixed salary. How does that position square with what you just said here, number one, and this authority from the Department of Labor?
I think it squares with when you have additional compensation that's tied to the hours worked. And we also have other factors here. We're not just relying on the addition of the pay. As you know, the court here may affirm the district court's decision on any grounds supported by the record. Here, there's multiple grounds. In addition to this issue, and it's undisputed that Mr. Hernandez received money that was tied to both the type and the number of hours he worked each week.
I want to continue on the definition of fluctuating work week and this fixed salary concept and your proposition that there's no authority. Let's talk about Lolly from the First Circuit, which is the circuit that decided O'Brien, that your colleague discussed earlier. In Lolly, the court there said that a predetermined commission on top of the fixed salary did not defeat the fluctuating work week, right?
Yes, it did.
Right, so that's additional compensation on top of the fluctuating work week, on top of the fixed salary that did not defeat and still was used to calculate the fluctuating work week, right?
I think that the Lolly is distinguishable in that regard. Lolly both discussed the situation here where compensation, additional compensation was tied specifically to hours worked and said that that is not compliant with the fluctuating work week or the FLSA. But if you get a bonus, that's not tied to the time that you've worked, and in that case, it was a commission. An alternative methodology permitting halftime is when someone's paid in part by commission. And here there's no dispute. Mr. Hernandez was never paid any form of his compensation.
But if fixed salary, a fixed salary in Regulation 114 is specific to one flat salary with nothing else in addition, if that's the proposition that we have to accept, then how does anything that is paid on top of that allowed, or how is allowing anything on top of that, how would that not defeat the fluctuating work week? And how is that different than what was paid here?
I believe, as I said before, that Your Honor, the preamble to the 2011 regulation 778.114, which was the applicable regulation at the time of this case, distinguishes between the two. If compensation, which is to use your term, is paid on top of the base salary, and it's based on anything other than hours actually worked, I mean, it's not tethered to hours worked. That appears to be, and the courts have said, they've distinguished that situation, which seems to be blessed by certainly some courts, versus the situation we have here, where the additional compensation is explicitly tied to both the type and number of hours worked. Here, it's all compounded by the fact that Plastipak did not divide by all hours worked when they did their calculation. Both the acknowledgement form that they had everyone sign and week after week after week, they divided by 40 hours. So that's another substantial departure from the fluctuating work week. This court has said explicitly that you have to divide by all hours worked.
Counsel, didn't that result in your client being paid more money?
Not more money than he would have been had the default methodology of just time and a half been used.
But if we did a regular fluctuating work week, in other words, if we determine that the fluctuating work week applies, and the employer used a denominator of 40 rather than the hours actually worked, doesn't that result in more money to your client?
It would, but Your Honor, I would submit to the court, I think that's circular reasoning. You can't use the fluctuating work week because they only divide by 40 hours, and the end result is that you're paying, and they paid Mr. Hernandez straight time. He received the identical rate for his hours up to 40 as he did beyond 40. And now retroactively, they're saying, yeah, but had we complied with a methodology that we did not comply with, we could have paid him less under the law than we did. So he's actually received a windfall here. We've paid him more than we had to, but they were never entitled to. The presumption, I think, of the question, which is, in my opinion, erroneous, Your Honor, is that they were never entitled to use a fluctuating work week in the first instance. No. It's true that paying straight time, if they had divided by all hours worked rather than 40 hours, and then instead of paying half time, the number that was derived by that calculation, they paid straight time and they didn't add in the time-based bonuses and additional pay for working certain shifts, then his pay would have been only half time. It would have been less potentially than what he received, but they didn't do any of those things. They did not comply with any of the prerequisites really, other than ensuring that he got paid more than minimum wage. They didn't comply significantly with any of the prerequisites, all of which have to be complied with in order to be able to use for the fluctuating work week in the first instance. So to say, I think it's a false choice to say, well, and that's, you know, the Ninth Circuit addressed this almost identically in the Parks case. And they say you can't look at, you're comparing apples to oranges. You can't say, yeah, but had they complied with the fluctuating work week, they only would have paid him halftime. Here they didn't, but they paid him something more than halftime. So didn't he actually get more than he would have under the law? that's a, to me, a false choice. I don't think that that's really what the law, that's not what the law requires. Certainly, if they had complied with the fluctuating work week, they could have paid this halftime, but only if they comply with the fluctuating work week. You can't just pay halftime, in other words, and then say, look, we paid straight time. We only had to pay halftime because there's a way we could pay halftime. We didn't qualify for that. But had we qualified, we could have paid him even less than we did. You sort of have, they sort of had to make their choice, and they did here, and they tried to cover their tracks. They paid him straight time, or his the same, the identical amount. It's undisputed, they paid him the identical amount for his overtime hours as they did for his non-overtime hours, hours 1 through 40 each week, and he got paid overtime. Under every iteration since it's been included, I think since 1961, of the regulation, 778.114C explicitly bans that. You can't do that. And they couldn't do that here. So to try and rationalize it, okay, retroactively, and say, yeah,
we paid. I'll return this to, one of the things that's been troubling me about this case, and I think this argument has been very helpful in elucidating this, and I want to get your response to this, is the difference that some courts have drawn, that you've drawn, between a commission-based bonus versus an hourly-based bonus, right? So one bonus is based on you having a successful week or selling something or producing more, and another kind of bonus would be based on the hours worked. Is the difference the economic realities of those two sort of functions, that those are two sort of an economic reality, as Mr. Cummings had talked about earlier, those two kinds of bonuses are just a different kind of bonus. The economic realities of those bonuses are different. Do you get my point?
Not exactly, Your Honor, but okay. I'll attempt to answer it. I don't think that they're two versions of the same thing, I guess, to answer your question. I think the problem with the fluctuating work. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Go for it.
The problem with the fluctuating work week, and Missel initially sought to resolve, is what do you do when someone works a non-fixed number of hours, but the amount of pay that they receive is the same every week, and that pay is intended to cover all of the hours that they work. And where you have a production-based bonus, that doesn't impact that analysis. A production-based bonus doesn't speak at all to this idea, and it's one of the seminal ideas of the fluctuating work week, is that the pay is supposed to cover all hours worked. And what you have, though, with a production-based bonus or commission based on production, it doesn't affect that analysis. What does affect the analysis is when you're separately paying for certain hours an additional amount because those hours have been worked, or because you're working a different type of hour, then the pay can't possibly be said to be covering all hours of work, because you're paying separately for hours of work. And here, not only are they doing that, they're actually, by using a 40-hour divisor, what they're saying, since the 30s, the Supreme Court has said, we don't look at what the parties say they're gonna do, we look at what the parties actually did. And here it's undisputed that what they did was they divided both the holiday pay, the shift differential pay, and the base pay each week, not by all hours worked, but by 40, and everything, and that evidence is that, again, obviously it's inherently incompatible with the fluctuating work week. It couldn't possibly be that it only covered 40 hours, but in actuality it covered all hours worked. And I think this court has, in the Wellington case, the Wethington case, the fluctuating work week only applies when the regular rate is determined by dividing the actual hours worked in a week by the rate per week. That's indisputably, that's not what happened here. No matter how, it is true that he worked more hours than 40 sometimes, but no matter how many hours he worked, whether he worked 32 or 35 or 40 or 45, they divided by 40 every single week. That's not the fluctuating work week. That's a 40-hour work week.
Counsel, your time has expired. Thank you. If you could wind up.
Okay, I think this is a good place to stop. I was just gonna say the fact that they divided by 40 demonstrates the exact opposite of the intent to pay, and that the pay would cover all hours worked, and rather it only covered 40 hours. That's why he's, and then moreover, the pay did not cover any overtime hours. it only covered the first 40 hours. So until he got paid his straight time pay, he had received no overtime pay.
Thank you. Mr.
Okay, Cummings. We'll start with the last point. You know, as a practical matter, calculating overtime, dividing by 40, it's the same number every week. You don't have to go and do a bunch of complicated, you know, they work 55 and a half hours this week. So there's a simplicity. And I think it's undisputed that Section 207 of the FLSA sets a floor on overtime. No court has ever said you can't pay them more. So yes, he's entitled to this one thing, is half time, is half of his regular rate. The fact that they pay him a lot more doesn't negate anything. You know, 207 is a floor. And I have to say, you know, the fluctuating work rule is not at issue in this case. No court, the rule itself, if Mr. Hernandez had never received a shift premium, we would not be here. There's all that avalanche of authority he talks about, all except the existence of the fluctuating work rule and its basic thing. They all assume that what MISL, most of them cite to MISL at some point. They fail to analyze MISL, and that's their mistake, but it just is a general proposition. And so that whole, there's no difference. The only question here is whether, and as is Judge Brasher, and whether an hours-based bonus. There's also no question whether you get any other kind of bonus added on top. And if the case law is clear, you just put that in the mix. That goes into the denominator. You divide the whole thing by that. So there's no question there. The only question is very specific case. If you add a bonus, it's time-based. And we have to take a second here, and I hope I don't go over, going to where this error came from. He talks about an avalanche of authority. All of that authority goes back to the O'Brien case. It goes back to the mistake O'Brien made. And every single case, if you look at it, actually truncates the language of 778.114. Now again, 771184 is a direct descendant of bulletin number 4. Every single time it got passed, he said, whoa, this is just an interpretive bulletin. We are just clarifying, we are not changing. So the intent of 114 is not to change anything that wasn't in bulletin number 4 or in the 1942 wage order that specifically called it a minimum. So the Department of Labor, until 2011, never intended to change it. So we look at that, give me a minute, because he will receive such fixed amount as straight time pay. This is the end of the first sentence of 114, for whatever hours, whether et cetera or funeral. That phrase, as I'm gonna receive something as straight time pay, that does not mean the whole straight time pay has to be fixed. It goes the other, that means the fixed has to go into the straight time pay. As straight time pay, you know, we're doing sentence like, that's an adverbial phrase. So if I say I pay you a money order as payment of the debt, that doesn't mean I can't also pay you a personal check as payment of the debt. I can't also pay you cash as payment of the debt. It's just that as phrase describes the role of fixed salary. It goes in as opposed to overtime. It's not going into overtime. And everybody, you look at O'Brien, you look at Lally, you look at Descartes, you look at every single case, you look at the 2011 proposed change, which is really just an interpretation, so it's got as less deference as possible under the administrative law. They all truncate that. They drop that as, or they put in an definite article rather than indefinite. They forget to say that 114 is not claiming that all the straight time pay. That sentence, English doesn't work that way. It's an as phrase. It's the role of the fixed, it's what the fixed salary does. It goes into straight time pay as opposed into overtime pay. It doesn't require that all the straight time pay, all the compensation must be fixed. There's no actual, you know, English is a very structured, logical language, and that is just a misinterpretation.
Can I ask you one quick, do you mind if
sure.
I ask you
that part?
So you had talked earlier about economic realities and needing to follow economic realities. And my question was, is distinguishing between commission-based bonuses, so bonuses based not on time, and these kind of shift premium bonuses that are based on time, does that distinction make sense as a matter of economic reality? Are those two separate kind of economic agreements between people?
No, because the economic reality that matters, what economic if you for MISL and for the establishment is the fixed salary itself. Whatever you add on top of the fixed salary, could be time-based or not time-based, does not change the economic reality. There's a slight but trivial and meaningless difference in the economic reality of the bonus, but it's trivial because it doesn't change the existence of the underlying actually fixed in practice, fixed in understanding, fixed in economic reality. That doesn't change. So, and the only reason you make a distinction, that distinction only comes from a misinterpretation of 114. Go back and look at Descartes, look back at O'Brien, look at Lally, look at all the district court cases that all cite back to O'Brien eventually. None of them don't eventually go back to O'Brien. So this avalanche is really an avalanche caused by the stone of O'Brien. And it made a mistake, it made two mistakes. It failed to go see whether this, there, one last thing, you destroy shift premiums with this, right? Because a shift premium of $30 gets translated to paying triple overtime. And it, that could be like $500, $400, $500, $600, $30 shift premium turns into a man. That means, essentially, that means salaried employees can't get shift premiums. Hourly can.
Has Mr. Cummings answered your question?
Yes. I'm done. Thank you.
Mr. Cummings? Okay.
I'm done. I really say that you were just, the point that you're destroying. No shift premium, no salaried employee can get a shift premium under this very artificial rule.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. We appreciate the presentation. And that brings us to the next case.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate you coming. Thank you.